Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Baumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. We've been hearing a lot from mayors lately. For instance, the Democratic race for the presidential nomination has been shaped by former mayors suggesting that, in an era of political gridlock, mayors get things done. Former Chicago mayor Rahm Emanuel delivers that same message in his book, The Nation City. He takes a close look at the experimentation taking place in the world's urban centers and puts forth the idea of a new kind of political power structure, where ideas flow from city to city instead of from Washington, D.C. The former mayor is familiar with that more traditional power structure. He was a senior advisor during the Clinton administration and served as chief of staff to President Barack Obama. We invited Emanuel to share his vision of a future shaped by cities, as well as his thoughts on the race for the White House, which took a big turn on Super Tuesday, the night before our talk. This conversation is sponsored by Alaska Airlines and was recorded at Temple Deherche Sinai in Seattle on March 5th, 2020.
Well, thank you all for coming out tonight. Mayor Emanuel, thanks for coming out tonight as well.
We should thank everybody else for coming out and doing everything that's going on.
So your brother's a doctor, right? Did you call him and ask him if you should be coming into Seattle right now?
I play a spin doctor on TV. That's pretty good. You sound like a Jewish mother already or something like that. I don't listen to my brother when it comes to... That's not true. I do cut.
Well, let's talk about you as spin doctor a little bit. We're going to talk about the book, but of course there is a lot of news happening right now.
Rumor has it.
You are the man to speak to. I think that you're probably the person who is most informed about the candidates who are running for the Democratic National or running for the Democratic nomination. And you have some very strong opinions about the race. Last night, Joe Biden did pretty well, and I feel like you're maybe happy about that. Are you?
This is what happiness looks like.
I know. You're positively beaming.
Yeah, I'm beaming. This is what 3 hours of sleep looks like. I was telling Mark earlier, like, we're on the set for whatever reason from 8 to 2. And I said at 1 o'clock, I said, has anybody, AP or whatever, called Texas? And they said, no. I said, I'm calling Texas. And George Stephanopoulos goes, well, based on what? I said, it's 1 o'clock. I'm exhausted. Let's just give it to him. And I want to go home. I want to go to bed. So here is, I do know, one is I know Joe Biden. I also served with Bernie Sanders. I know Joe Biden. Going back to when we passed the Violence Against Women Act when I was working for President Clinton, but also the Chief of Staff's office abuts the Vice President's office. The Chief of Staff's office is 6 feet bigger than the Vice President's office. And it has an outside porch. And I know him well, but it's beyond that, and I know him as capable, et cetera, but it is also, and I have a piece, I think tomorrow or the next day in the Post, Washington Post, about, it's also for political reasons, and I'm upfront about the political reasons. So quickly, if you look at how Bill Clinton wins in 92, 98, you look at the midterms in 06, you look at how President Obama wins in both 08 and 12, and then you look at the 2018 midterms. While they're slightly different, they're basically the same national strategy. And it's what I call a metropolitan majority. And even in the midterms of 06 and 2018, to win, you have to build a real good urban, suburban coalition and minimize your losses in the rural areas. And that's the strategy. Every national election, and I would like to note that in the last 100 years, or at least since Franklin Delano Roosevelt will stay there, there's only 3 Democrats ever got reelected president. Roosevelt, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. 2 of them are alive, so they're kind of relevant to this conversation. And to me, it's not just the presidency. The House is up, the Senate is up, the Supreme Court is up, even though you don't get to vote on it, and every governorship and state house. And what Bernie is offering politically, and you should, I mean, people should evaluate, this is a political judgment, is, you know, is we're gonna throw everything that's worked before and try this, our revolution. Which is why go with these suburban, fickle, moderate voters when all we need to do is really energize the base and it will happen. Now, you're basically rejecting six successful national models for something that's never been tried. I will note one of the reasons he really did, forget the African-American piece or whatever, he did poorly yesterday is because young voters did not show up. So if it's not going to happen in the primary, you want to take a lark on the general election. Now, I don't want somebody picking Ruth Bader Ginsburg's decision, replacement, but Joe Biden. Okay, I don't. So, now, is it ideological? Yes, but it's more, it is like ideological 10 and 90% pure political, and I want to win. Hmm. And I am a middle child. I joke, middle children wrote a book, War or Peace, we could do either one. I want to win, and I think this is, and I think that Biden has both the kind of demeanor, and I think character is a piece of this. So one, just pure electoral map in Pennsylvania, Michigan that are central. I think Wisconsin and Arizona are going to rise as the big races, big states, and so it's purely political. And then I think on somewhat. When you think of Clinton, you think Obama, you even think of Trump or Bush, character of the person matters. And I think while Democrats are very angry at Trump, and he gives us a lot of material, the voters we need are exhausted. And exhausted is not the same as anger. And if you look at the vice president, he has the demeanor, et cetera. If you want anger, I'm interrupting myself. If you want anger, between Bernie and Trump, Trump's gonna win that. If you want calm versus chaos, if you want character versus amoral character, Joe lines up exactly how we want it on the kind of mono to mono way, right? So in the long way of answering is, yes, I am very happy.
So it's, last night was a lot of voters who maybe would have been inclined to say that they would vote for Biden a year ago kind of came home, right, after maybe testing the waters with a lot of different candidates. But Biden is still the same candidate he is now as he was, you know, last summer. And there are definitely some, you know, there are some weak points in his campaign. And so how would you advise, if you were asked?
I'll tell you what I told him.
What did you tell him?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. Look. First of all, I love President Obama. I love President Clinton. They're all flawed. We're all flawed, okay? They're flawed. They had flawed campaigns. This is a big deal. I just love being here in Seattle, okay? I mean, they're all, I've been yelled at for 6 years, okay? So. Here's what I said. In the end of the day, the overarching thing when you run through everything was who would match up greatest against Donald Trump. Voters, our voters, and I don't know if there's other Republicans that are here. I'll hug you afterwards if you're allowed to hug here in Seattle now. But look, here's the deal. They want to win. And they're very clear. They've been saying it for a year, whether people want to listen. Their whole motto is, who can beat Donald Trump? Now, if you go through this process last night, I mean, think about the last week. Joe has a story that goes viral when he talks to the minister in South Carolina. You know, his ascent is pre-Clyburn. Clyburn puts a lot of caffeine in it, takes off. You then have this fear against what Bernie could rot for the party. There's a coalescing. And Joe takes off and wins. Now, that was all about endorsements. Now, what I find fascinating as somebody that's spent a little too much time of his life studying politics and political and presidential, Democrats like to fall in love. Republicans like to fall in line. Last week or last night, what you saw was Democrats falling in line, not in love, which is really unusual for us as a party. Number two, it's probably the best 4 days Joe Biden's had in the last year. And I'm not talking about 4 days in a row, really. You know, he's had like 1 year, 4 months later, another one over there. You know, that's four in a row. Now, the key is the next set that comes up is Mississippi, Biden. You guys are up. Idaho's up. Okay, like there's one state that stands out. Everybody else, you could tell you where four of the five go. Michigan. Michigan stands alone for symbolic reasons, because the last time, Michigan stands alone because it's the first real one outside of Minnesota in the industrial Midwest, the battleground. So blah, 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 blah. You don't need to go through all that. And if you know anything about Michigan, Michigan is a basically, if you're the establishment, and I just, since we're in a synagogue, I just cleaned it up, okay? You know, I didn't say anything, I just, even if it's a reform synagogue, I still cleaned it up, okay? So I told them today, I said, if you think you're gonna go into a week from now running off a string of endorsements, the voters in Michigan are gonna kick your ass. They're going to do it. And I said, you can't do that. So you won. You cannot win a week from now with the same strategy you just won this week. So my one suggestion to him was, you're getting like this. A second, like, who is this guy? He's walking like a winner, talking like a winner. Because they basically saw a guy moping around for 5 months. Reintroduce yourself. Put a 60-second bio. You know, remember the black and white that you always do when the candidate's about to be introduced at the convention? I said, do a 60-second. Go upstairs to Scranton. Show them the apartment you grew up in. I said, reintroduce yourself because you're getting a second look. Nobody knows you. You ran basically Obama's co-pilot, and I can beat Trump. That's really thin gruel. Mm-hmm. And the one thing we all know, whatever happens on Tuesday is not true by Thursday. That has been consistent for 6 months. So Joe's, I love him. It's like one debate away from like, oh, what are we doing? So my view is you got to win Michigan. You can't win it the way you won the last 10 states yet last night. Reintroduce yourself. And contrary to what you've done, go give a policy speech on education. Now, you have this big rift, left versus right. You know, Medicare for all, no public option. What? The one thing the progressives and the moderates and Dower Party agree on, education. Go give it a speech on a topic that's unifying. Do advertising that's bio-driven, not issue-driven. You haven't done any of that. And introduce yourself, but do not, whatever you do, do not start rolling out all the senators and governors that are going to come running to endorse you. Whatever you do, because Michigan loves to tell you to go stuff it. And if you go do that, the anti-establishment state is going to stick it to you.
So you think he's going to listen to you?
You know, I don't, you know, I don't, they're going to also have to, I said the last night on TV, since this is, they're going to have to really buttress the campaign. This is not a, you know, whatever you want to say, Donald Trump's campaign is going to come at you. And they're coming, they're not waiting. And so they're going to have to buttress the campaign. I think they're going to do certain things, but, you know, I mean, when I, so, you know, they'll do whatever they're going to do.
Yeah, all right.
It won't be the first time a president or a presidential candidate didn't listen to what I have to say, okay? So I don't take it personally anymore, okay?
So I want to talk a little bit about, I want to sort of seg into the book and talk a little bit about some of the other candidates. So so this book, The Nation City, which came out last week, and it's a really good read. I appreciate
it. You're just saying that because I'm here.
No, I actually read the whole book. And I know that some of the people who have interviewed you have not read the whole book. Yeah. I can tell when I'm watching the interviews,
too.
I'm just like, you did not read that book. You know, the tagline is why mayors are now running the world. We had a handful of mayors vying for the Democratic nomination. And all of them, or former mayors, all of them, except for Bernie Sanders, who was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont, a while ago, are gone now. And so I'm kind of curious.
It's kind of like an Agatha Christie novel, and then there were none.
And then there were none.
Oh, I can say that. I don't care.
I'm kind of curious. You talk about this in the book a little bit, but it does mayoral success I mean, we've seen gubernatorial success translate to presidential success, but are we seeing that mayoral success does not necessarily translate to at least political success, campaign success on the national stage?
It is a, so there's a couple answers I get. I didn't write it because I thought mayors would make for, I wasn't advocating for the presidency, I was advocating what was going on in cities that are, right. I think are the center of gravity. I had noticed, I've worked in the Oval Office, the Halls of Congress, and the fifth floor of municipal government. I thought the center of gravity of our politics was moving. And having worked in all those, wanted to add my two cents of what that means for our body politic. That's one. Two, you kind of talk about, so let me say two ways to you. I don't think they're contradictory. One is you talk about, is a mayoral success, is that a good enough resume like a governor's success for the White House? And I would say yes, because it's actually about their failures, not their successes. I think that's a big, I think a lot of people miss about presidential politics, the role failures play, which is true for all of us in our lives. My example I use to always describe this or try to illustrate this point, go back in history. You have the Bay of Pigs, a total fiasco. Cuban Missile Crisis, total success. Now, what if either A, the Bay of Pigs had not happened, or B, the Cuban Missile Crisis had happened first? And Kennedy had the wherewithal to realize the Joint Chiefs were full of it, that only he could have, he had his own instincts, he didn't want to do it, he inherited it from Eisenhower, he didn't think he could question them. They told him it was going to be a success, signs off on it, it's a total debacle in 24 hours. And he learns from it, and it's very important, all the lessons he draws on for the Cuban Missile Crisis comes out of the Bay of Pigs failures. Mayors fail, governors fail, legislators, they have a bad vote. They didn't co-sponsor the peace alert. You know what I mean? It's chief executives, if you're in that, the dogfight, those failures are informative and guideposts for your successes. Second thing I would say to you is that one is the mayor of London is now the prime minister of England. And his first thing he does, I want to build a train from here to there, very mayor-like. And when you think about the government people have confidence in today, I mean, government's at all-time low, like other institutions. Your confidence in America of national government is about 24, 25%, depending on what poll you believe. Locally, it's 73 to 75. And one thing about politics, and since you've watched some of this, and I've said this before, but I think it's very informative. In New Hampshire, Mayor Pete doesn't get the normal bounce out of Iowa because of all the technology screw-ups. Has an okay debate, and he comes really close to Bernie within a point. And my view is the reason is Biden's attack ad backfires. He says, I dealt with healthcare. I was sitting by President Obama's side when he negotiated with Iran, cobblestone streetlights. And everybody's going, I'll go with the cobblestones and the streetlights. That's pretty good government. And that's the government you believe in, and that's the government you want because it touches your lives, and that's the one you're comfortable with. All this other stuff, you're pretty cynical about it ever happening.
Right.
And
but
so to me, that is what mayors, and then I will say last thing. You guys are dealing with this. We're dealing with it in Illinois. I mean, the country's dealing with it. We are experiencing something we've never experienced, the deaths of despair. We have a whole generation, mainly young men, but not limited to, dying of opiates, alcohol, suicide, this alienation. And mayors are uniquely qualified of weaving places of faith, worship, community groups, neighborhood groups, not-for-profits, and creating a place of belonging and community in a time in which people feel none of that exists for them. And so I think at a lot of levels, both political, policy, and most importantly, which is what's aching our soul as a country, is mayors are, I think, uniquely qualified, which is, even though all of them have failed in this process, I think it's interesting that for the first time since Grover Cleveland, you had all the governors drop out, and the ones that were standing were mayors. And I think they do bring an attribute that people, they're getting closer to the itch and scratching it than any other official.
I feel like they didn't do a very good job of, like, it's almost like the mayors were a little self-conscious about those small accomplishments, right? It took Joe Biden to bring that out for Pete Buttigieg. Buttigieg was maybe too focused on coming up with a national, like, policy sort of list of things that he was going to do. And I heard you say some in an earlier interview about that there is just like a lack of feel to these candidates, that they're not talking about human about the human beings that they whose lives they impact, right? They're so focused on policy that the debates that we're watching are really in a way kind of bloodless, and that they don't have human beings in them.
Well, they remind you of more of a gladiator fight, at least the last one.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Well, think about this. Senator Klobuchar's one time that she really takes off is when she drops being what I have written about this. She's no longer using her Senate voice, and she uses her Minnesota voice. And, like, people just, like, it's not the whole debate. It's like the last 10 seconds of the debate. And when they spoke to that, they just ran to it because it was so fresh, so raw, and so endearing. If Amy had stayed with that, or that became her voice the whole way, her race would be different. And a lot of these people, look, campaigns are revealing. The one thing I know, having been by two individual side, in the end of the day, the hood gets lifted and they see whether you got 8 cylinders, 6 cylinders, or 4 cylinders, and whether it's all working. And it's a revealing part. I mean, who else? I'm a byproduct of my experiences. Bill Clinton is going into New Hampshire. The draft letter is out. Jennifer Flowers just holds a press conference. We're dead. He's at 35. He's at 6%. He's done. And he's, like 2 a.m. at bowling alleys with just the people cleaning the bowling balls. Nobody's there. He's walking down malls in Manchester. And he gives this town hall, and he does 3 things. He says, the hits on me are nothing like the hits your kids are going to take if we don't turn this country around. I'm going to be here until the last dog's here. And he shows a part of Bill Clinton that people, he becomes, basically the comeback kid. And it was a revealing moment of what he was made of. And that truth is, people hung with him his whole 8 years of his presidency because they knew in the end of the day he wouldn't give up on them. And so to me, those are campaigns are very revealing about the capacity and the character of a candidate. And people have a pretty good nose for it.
I wonder if mayors...
I don't know why I just did that. If I said the nose, what part of the body I was talking about. I was helping you folks here in Seattle. The nose.
I wonder if mayors, though, are in a way more exposed than governors are, because they're still one step closer to the street than, actually where stuff happens. And, just thinking about what happened in the campaign, both Mayor Bloomberg and Pete Buttigieg were kind of raked across the coals for policing issues. You yourself have had issues with abuse of power by police and responding to that. And that kind of becomes that becomes their entire identity in a way, because they're so close to that point of conflict. Is it possible to get out of a mayoral tenure clean enough that you can actually run a national campaign and not get beat up?
I take the train. I did this when I took it when I was a congressman. I took it 3 times a week when I was mayor. I still take it to get to work. And when you're mayor, you either get this or another digit, okay? Now when you're ex-mayor, you just get, hey. So you are close and you own everything in that. You own all the good, all the bad. And if you're running for president, this happens to be that the issue of police and oversight and community policing is heightened because of a lot of other issues. But I do want to say one other thing. That's true for them. As you know, this is a piece I'm working on about on politics. You would agree that Joe Biden got raked over the coal for the 1994 crime bill and incarceration?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did pretty well in the black community. So I think that how we think about what happens in campaigns, how people, I can analyze why I think Mayor Bloomberg's answer did not work. Because I don't think that kind of the US soldier in the Korea prison? I don't believe in stop and frisk. I mean, he looked like he was lip syncing rather than saying, look, I believed it. It went random. You know, he could have said 100 different things, but he said, I disagree with it. I learned this. And you know, when you leave a church and the first thing you do is you call Al Sharpton and say, did you hear what I said? It doesn't have any authenticity. It's all political. Now, that's slightly different than Mayor Pete, because his moment is during the campaign. It's not a policy from the past. But the general thrust of what you're saying is true. Mayors own everything in a way that a legislator, I mean, Joe Biden's problem is going to be, Bernie's going to hit him about his voting record. It's not like the mayor of a city, all the stories, et cetera. And you should think about it as a career because your political advice is right. You got to own your city and not run away from it. Don't try to be this when this is your story and you got to own your story a lot more.
So I want to talk about one more thing in regards to how kind of your thoughts on mayors relate to this race. And you wrote this near the end of your book. Do you mind if I read it?
It depends how you read.
All right. Dramatically. It would behoove progressives now, given their dominance in urban areas, to concentrate on local government, not to think of policies going from top down or bottom up, but instead to think of them as flowing horizontally across the country and across the world from city to city to city. I thought this was really interesting because the light bulb that it turned on in my head was one that are Sanders supporters relying on an outdated idea of politics, which is that they're looking for change from the top down, which is essentially exactly what they're looking for, right? I mean, they're looking for a president who is going to make all these widespread changes. And your book makes quite a good argument for all these changes that are happening on the city level. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just wonder if it is more the approach to politics rather than the actual policy that the Sanders campaign is undertaking that irritates you so?
It doesn't. It's not the look.
You get a little irritated. It seems like when you're talking about. I just got.
Do I look irritated to you? I think you're irritating me. No. So here's what I would say. I first of all, let me say a couple things. One about the concept. One of the points I try to bring out in the book, and you guys own this, you kicked off the minimum wage. Okay, now look, the last time the minimum wage was raised, I was a congressman. $7.25. You guys are at $15. Okay? Ideas today no longer move locally up, which is vertical. There's a whole chapter in the book about ideas move horizontally. And there's a change going on. So we increased our minimum wage. Cities across the country increased the minimum wage. 2 points I'll bring to you. I started a policy in Chicago called the Chicago Star Scholarship, which I'm very, very, very proud of, which is if you get a B average in high school in the city, we make community college free. All tuition, all books, all transportation. And a dreamer can get it. There's more cities. I think there's the cities I do know that are doing it, but there's more than this. Is Boston, Louisville, Denver, San Francisco, and Oakland, all replicating. Okay? I knew that I was testing you. Has anyone been called by the Secretary of Education? Has anybody been called to test? And everybody's different. You know, mine's a B average. I don't know how you're doing in Seattle. Okay, but has anybody been called by the Congress or Senate to go out and testify? And nobody's waiting, because we know 12th grade may have been good enough for our commitment the last 100 years. We're going to have to make 14th grade the new minimum. Okay? To me, that tells you about ideas move. Your guys kicked off minimum wage, and there was a study recently done showing that while employment's gone X, poverty and incomes, et cetera, the cities that adopted minimum wages starting 3 or 4 years ago have actually reduced poverty at a faster rate than cities and parts that did not. Okay, now, the government is at 725. I don't know what Washington State is, but cities across the country, Democrats, Republicans, medium, big, small, all doing this, all doing it. And so ideas move that away. Second, to the Bernie part isn't so much, and the book starts with this anecdote in education. 60 years ago, 50 years ago, when cities are burning, and you know there's flight, et cetera, Lyndon Johnson comes up with the model city. The cornerstone of the model city, Head Start. And it's basically the way Lyndon Johnson's thinking about it. I'll give money to cities, try to keep them together, keep mayors, and they're just like, mayors are on their backs, and the cities are on their backs. 50 years later, President Obama's trying to create universal full-day pre-K. Boehner won't let it happen, former secretary, former committee chairman of education. So what does Obama do? He doesn't give in. He calls together 200 mayors to the White House and says, I can't get this done, you guys get this done. And across the country, New York, Chicago, all the cities, are all passing and implementing. Some are doing three-year-olds, some are doing 3 and 4, but everybody's implementing some form of pre-K. And it's happened, and mayors take the initiative because the federal government is broken. Now, to my challenge about Bernie Sanders is not actually top-down, et cetera. My problem, now look, I negotiated the Children's Health Initiative for President Clinton, and I was chief of staff when we passed the ACA. And I have more healthcare legislative background and experience than I want to do. I really, when I became mayor and I had to deal with healthcare in the city, I said I left Obama's side so I'd never have to deal with this again, and now I have to deal with this issue again. My problem is a political policy one. I think one of the most important things in what the book's about is that you're looking in the wrong places to find progressive politics. It's in your backyard. That's where progressive initiatives and creativity is happening.
We'll be back with more from my conversation with Rahm Emanuel in a minute. But first, a message from our sponsor, Alaska Airlines. Alaska flies to over 115 destinations worldwide, with an average of 1,200 daily flights across the United States, Mexico, Canada, and Costa Rica. Every Alaska flight has high-speed Wi-Fi, free chat, free movies, a rotating seasonal menu, and the highest-rated customer experience of any North American airline. Alaska also tops the charts in environmental sustainability, having been ranked the most fuel-efficient U.S. airline for 7 years running. It's the highest-rated U.S. airline on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, and it helps passengers offset the carbon impact of every trip they take. Learn more and book your next trip at alaskaair.com.
You couldn't get a public option when you have 59 Democratic senators. What makes you think you're going to create Medicare for all with maybe 49 Democrats? Okay? And my other thing is, what is the basic assumption of progressive politics? Is that people have an affirmative view of government as a force for good. And if what you do is fail on your number one pledge, you don't just fail on that pledge. You A, reinforce your cynicism that government cannot do run a one-car parade, and B, it has collateral damage to climate change, to an infrastructure transportation bill. It doesn't just stop at the water edge. Oh, well, I failed at Medicare for All. Well, that's not, okay, I'll go on to the next subject. No, it just starts bleeding through everything. And so my view is, I'm all for, You know, my father in 1962 is an immigrant with maybe 30 words of the English language under his belt, barely and no practice, quits the AMA in 62 over national health care. Nothing would make me happier than have national health care, but I think it's a real politically reckless thing to do to pledge people something you're not going to get done, so it only reinforces their cynicism that government is broken. And I think it's a real mistake. Now, does that look irritated? I think I was I think I was okay not bad. That was just a plain, calm explanation.
Let's get down to the kind of the nitty-gritty of the book. I have a couple things that just questions that popped up in my mind as I was reading it. You know, and this book is it's a buffet of policies, programs, partnerships, and projects, and it's there's a lot going on. You did a lot in your time as mayor in Chicago. And you write about a lot of other mayors who have done a lot in the last decade or so, 15 years or so. One thing that isn't really brought up in the book, though, is the fact that that in this last decade, we also have had a historic economic expansion. Mm-hmm. And I kept on coming back to the question of, is the expanding economy driving the positive change in the cities, or is the positive change in the cities driving the economic expansion? So, I mean, I know it's a little chicken and egg. And also, it felt, you know, as far as all the positive indicators within the cities of unemployment and all this investment, a lot of it, I'm like, well, the economy was doing well. Of course things were going in that direction. How do you approach that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, nothing's just good and bad. Nothing's just good. So,
right.
You know, I mean, there are some, I happen to think, like, at least on the part about Chicago, we weren't just riding a good economy. And what I mean by that is, one is, for 7 consecutive years, we're the number one city for corporate relocations. And for 7 consecutive years, we were the number one city in America for direct foreign investment. So not like once or twice, but 7 consecutive. And you know, we don't get Russian hot money, thank God. We don't get Chinese hot money that's trying to hide. We don't get any Venezuelan or Brazilian money that's trying to hide. And so it was investments that was being done because it was a good return. And so, yes, the economy's good, but the real question then for a mayor is, and a city, is what are you doing to drive that? Now, I'm seared by a couple things. So in the height of the worst part of the recession, and I don't know if you know this, but every Thursday night, right before the first Friday of the month, you get the unemployment numbers. And Thursday night at 9 o'clock, the president, and if he's got a really good chief of staff, you get the numbers. And like, you know, we're losing 800,000 jobs a month. And you know, we're in a fetal position. And the unemployment goes up to 10.9%. The unemployment rate for people with a BA is 4.6. So unemployment's at 11 for the country. If you have a BA, you're basically at full employment. That's what 4.6, 4.3 is. But education had become a divider in our country rather than a way of a bridge. And that was the impetus behind the free community college, et cetera. And companies, cities, et cetera, are chasing talent. Now, the race for talent isn't over. The second part, I think, and this is an important part, and I call income inequality as the manifestation of what I call the diploma divide. And our goal is, and this gets to society, to the divisions, to what's running through cities, the real question is, can we get more winners in the winner circle? Because this game, and I used to say this to the downtown business leaders of Chicago, if we can't figure out how to get the people from Englewood, which is on the south side of Chicago, Woodlawn, Chatham, feeling like they can see this success, but either they or their children can't participate, there is not a moat I can build that's big enough to protect you. And we as a society, not just Chicago, this is true of Seattle, we have to figure out how to get more people feeling like the success of Seattle includes them, and more importantly, their children. And I, you know, and this may be, we were talking earlier, I mean, when I gave up dance, I was gonna become an early childhood educator. I believe firmly in education as the most important thing you can not only do for your city, the most important thing you can individually do as a parent for your child, and it's the most important thing also you can do for the viability of our country, but more importantly, our cities and what they're doing. And just sitting there and say, okay, I have low unemployment and we have a lot of buildings going up. Okay, this is a window. What are you gonna do with it? The other part of that is, I think there are things that you have to do as a city to make sure that there are more people, more neighborhoods, more communities that are part of that winning circle. Now, we made a major dent in like food deserts in Chicago. We opened up about, depending on how you count it, 8 to 10 stores in former food deserts in the city of Chicago. We did a number of different things to deal with that, et cetera. Both it's economics, I think it's public health in the sense of fresh fruits and vegetables in a neighborhood, but more importantly to the communities that didn't have those major grocers, it was also respect. That it meant that their community counted. But you gotta do transportation, you gotta do schools, you gotta do the park district, you gotta do the libraries, and that neighborhood, both residentially and retail-wise, can come alive and be a vibrant effort. And I don't think, I can give you all the data points. I used to say this as a mayor, but if a child in Edgewater on the north side looks at the city and says, that's my city, and a child in Englewood from the south side looks at it and goes, like, that might as well be New York. I mean, I don't know what that is. Then we will never achieve our potential. But if both children on their way to school can look at their city, which is this incredible skyline, which represents power, optimism, opportunity, and both see the same thing. New York, Seattle, Hong Kong, Beijing, game on, let's go. And that's the challenge of not just having a good time, but how do you use that good time for maximum long-term benefit? And for everybody, and it's look, there are good days and bad days on this, but I think there are a set of policies you can put in place, and I'll take one thing. So we created, and the Urban Institute called it the most innovative policy approach, and this also then underscores the first item. So I decided that, let's say you're zoning a building at, I don't, just 12 floors. We'll let you go to 14, but all the additional has to go into a neighborhood opportunity fund. That fund then invests on the south and west side, restaurants, coffee shops, flower shops, all the retail economy that have been unbanked for 30 years and starving. So the success of downtown becomes the glue for the neighborhoods that have been deprived of economic investment. So like when McDonald's built their headquarters in Chicago, it kicked 3.3, 3.2 million into the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund, which funded about 30 businesses at 100, you know, knocking down a wall for a new part of the restaurant, fixing up the HVAC, et cetera. And to me, that was a way of bridging or using downtown to be part of the neighborhood, both politically and economically. Two, what I found both I'm happy about and I'm really sad. So we thought in the first 3 years it would kick off about $40 million. It's kicked off $170 to $190 million. So that's like, the federal aid to a city is the block grant. I don't know what you guys get, but in Chicago we get $70 million. So a policy we developed just 4 years ago surpassed the federal government's number one aid to cities. And that just told you that, it reaffirmed to me, the federal government's turned their back on cities. They've turned their back on investing in the future of this country, and we are left to our own kind of enterprise and entrepreneurship to come up with things to solve our problems and move our city and all parts of our city together. And some days you do really good things at it, and some days you don't, you fall flat on your face about it.
So, and this actually leads into this next question pretty well, which is that, I mean, you got a lot done. And there's a lot written between the
lines.
How come
I feel like the second part of this question is not a good question?
No. It's good. Okay, yeah. There is a lot written between the lines in this book. And I want to read another passage as an example. So you wrote about, this is actually about how you, when professional sports teams were pressing for money from the city, there was a tax break for the Bulls and the Blackhawks for their
United Center,
and you were going to let that tax break expire, and so you said that the owners of the Blackhawks threatened to cancel his plans. They threatened to cancel their plans to put the hockey team's training facility in the city as an act of retribution for not extending the tax break. I turned up the heat on him a bit. The Blackhawks' new downtown training facility is really beautiful. So there's a lot of this. There's a lot of sort of like, there's this problem, and sometimes it's put in parentheticals. You use parentheticals in a very amusing manner, but it's just sort of like you sort of jump to the accomplishment, and there's like, how did he get it done? And I kind of wanted to.
Well, that's
just
book number two.
Right, but I have to imagine that somebody who gets so much done, you have to have a guiding principle as far as like how to negotiate. What is it?
Well, let me just retell the story again. It's really great. Let me say this. I don't know what you've done here, so if I'm stepping on some political landmine, I'm just going to plow at 50 miles an hour so I don't have that. I think it's ridiculous. Look, and I have nothing. Jerry Reinsdorf owns the Bulls. Rocky Wirtz owns the Blackhawks. The Ricketts family owns Wrigley. I'm not giving them taxpayer money. I think it's nuts. I got schools. I got stuff. You buy the Cubs. You overpaid. Ain't my problem. Welcome to the free market. I have no problem. You overpaid. You're the schmuck, not me. Now, I'm not saying anything to you I haven't said to them. I said, you want $200 million because the difference between your bid and the cover bid was $200 million. Go to hell. I said, now what I did say, no, I want to be clear, and it's a part of time. I said, here's the deal. You want to put big video screens in there? Everybody acted like the Wrigley Field was the city's. It's not. It's theirs. Now it's a historic landmark. You want to do all that? Fine. I'll let you do that so you can get the revenue early and then bankroll it. I don't have a problem. But I am not giving you the revenue we get to subsidize all the improvements you got to do because you overpaid. Not happening. Now, number two, on another part of town, the west side, there was the United Center, which is where the Blackhawks and Bulls play. 20 years earlier, the prior mayor had given them a good deal on property tax. Now, 20 years ago when they moved there on the west side, nothing was there. And like it was burnt out from 1960s. I'm not so sure that was a mistake, because when you look at what's happened on the west side, you put this anchor and et cetera. But that was then and this is now. It's no, you're the investment that you got, the return you got, the city did well, you did well. I'm not rewriting that. And I told both Rocky and Jerry Reinsdorf, I said, and property taxes, unlike the other tax for Wrigley, that goes to schools. You think I'm going to give you this extension? I said, by the time, if I said stupid enough to say yes, the teachers union are going to be both killing both of themselves, and I'm throwing you in front of me. I said, I'm not doing this. And I said, you guys are nuts to ask me to do this. And so we had a big fight. And I said, they said, well, we're not going to. The Bulls and the Blackhawks played in the suburbs. I said, so keep playing there. Your players hate it. You have to move into the city. Your players have no more interest of driving out to Lake Forest and playing out there and then coming in and playing a game. You don't want to do it? Don't do it. I'm not extending this. They both put their training facility because why? They get more restaurants, more bars, and they keep all the people for tourism in off season. They had an economic interest. And I just told them up front, here's what we're going to do. And beyond that, you know the skyboxes. I don't know why I did this, but that's what it's doing. I don't know what you guys have done this virus has done weird things. Anyway, we used to give tax subsidies to companies for skyboxes. I eliminated it. You don't want to entertain? I don't care. But I'm not subsidizing you entertaining clients, and we take out that. So we eliminate it. So I've been consistent in that. I think I say in the book, now all the building trades supported me, and business support me. I am not pro-business, I'm not pro-labor, I'm pro-growth. That is a different thing. We'll do a lot to do growth, but I am not using taxpayer money to help you build a stadium of which you are going to get all the economic benefit. And I just told, and now it got a little rocky with Rocky Wirtz, and he was, we were tough. Now, in the end of the day, they built the training facility. And to his credit, and I want to say this, we have two ice skating rings, and one is for the kids in the community, of which he does, like, I forgot the exact thing, but I think it's like 20,000 hours a year of free ice skating and lessons and stuff for the kids. So he's done good things, but it's not worth extending the property tax gift that he got 20 years ago to do that. And I think corporate welfare is as bad as other forms of welfare that create a dependency.
So I saw an interview.
I think you were doing really good at the readings. Pick another chapter.
No, that's it. That's it. You just like hearing your own words.
Yeah.
I saw an interview where the interviewer said, this book reminded me of the kind of book someone writes when they're going to run for president. Which I was like, you did not read that book.
Yeah.
Because it isn't. I mean, it is so dark when it comes to the federal government. It reads as somebody who wants nothing to do with D.C. at all. I think, well, and yet, you know, I see you in your pundit role, you know, after debates. And, man, you love it so much. You're, like, in it. You're, like, such, you're a pugilist in the ring, right? Like you're such an astute strategist. You're ready with the. Like,
I'm gonna call my brother Zeke. What's a pugilist? No, I'm joking. Okay.
Boxer.
No. I'm joking. I got that. I went to Sarah once.
It feels like you really love being in the arena in that way. And yet this book doesn't give any indication of what you're gonna do next. You make one hint that you would maybe be willing to be the infrastructure czar. But what are you going to do next?
I'm thinking of taking over public television in Seattle. What do you think?
Yeah.
Look, I'm not done with public service. I was done with, you know. No, being mayor of Chicago, well, here's like simple. I get elected to Congress in 2 years. So in 2004, Nancy says, I'd like you to become the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. We take the House. She says, I want you to stay chair of the DCCC and become caucus chair. So I'm there basically 2 terms, and I'm now fourth. 2 years later, Obama makes me chief of staff. 2 years later, I'm mayor. I think you could agree that both chief of staff, his first chief of staff, and then mayor were massive turnarounds. I was dead tired. I mean, really dead tired. And the other thing is, Emmy and I were empty nesters. She had been, you know, when I was dating her, I pledged I would never run for office. I'm 6 elections behind that pledge. I mean, what's 6 elections? So the truth is, I had come to a point in my life, I was tired, I had done what I, you know, the goal wasn't to see how long I could stay mayor, it's just, the goal was, what could I do while I was mayor? And I don't take anything along for people that want to stay. The question isn't how long you're there, in my view. That's a measure. For me, the measure was, what did I do when I was mayor? And I am going to come back to politics when I'm both rested, and re-energized, and have thought through, I think, this unique moment in time, which is where all times have changed, et cetera. There's no one time that's static. But I think we're going through an unprecedented amount of change. And I really want to understand it, and I really want to take the time to question. Maybe I'm full of shit, and I don't know the answers to what I think I know the answers to. what I think is some of the solutions to these problems. And I think I do. I think I've been fortunate to work with two great men and learn a ton from both of them. I think I've applied a lot of politics and stuff like that to it. But I want to take some time to look at what's going on around us and think about these things. And then when I come back to politics, be smarter about it. We didn't touch on one thing, and I would say, so I don't know if it will be running. I don't know if it will be appointment. I don't know if it will be in another administration. And I don't know if I'll just stay doing what I'm doing. So I'm not in any rush right now to figure out. I do love it. And I think, you know, I am the child and the grandchild of an immigrant. My grandfather came to the city of Chicago a little over 100 years ago. Since we're in a synagogue, his little Pisher grandson is the mayor of the city he came to when he was 10. This is a great country. It's an incredible, and my dad came here, and he didn't know English. His three kids have grown up. He gave us love and an education, and his son, and remember, his entire beginning in life, he doesn't know English, and he sues the city of Chicago in 1964 over lead in household paint, and his son is now the mayor of that city. It's a great country. It is unbelievable, but I want to understand it, and I don't think I have all the things. But I do think in politics, you didn't ask this, and this is my one rule, at least mainly for mayors, true about governors and presidents, but true very specifically for mayors, which is you have to be idealistic enough to know why what you're doing and why you're doing it. And then you have to be ruthless enough and tough enough to get it done. And if you think about the good presidents, you think about the good governors or the mayors, it's one thing to be idealistic enough, but if you don't have any of the political chops, you ain't going nowhere. And if all you have is political chops without the sense of what that vision is, you're just gonna run in circles. And sometimes we try to say one person's this or one person's that. And if you really look at Kennedy, you look at Reagan, you look at Roosevelt, you look at Lincoln, you look at President Obama, President Clinton, they're very thoughtful about the vision they have. And then they have the fortitude to get that done. And that's what makes a really good public servant, is to have that combination.
All right, Mayor, they're giving us the hook, so I'm going to ask you one more question, all right? So in the book, you say that you have three lists. You have a to-do list for today, you have a to-do list for this week, and then you have a to-do list for the big issues. Yeah. And the to-do list for the big projects, the big issues, you keep in your desk, and the other two you keep in your pocket. You know, thinking about that that big issues list, you, in your time as mayor, you came up short in a couple places, ridding the city of guns, lifting every Chicago resident out of poverty. But you accomplished O'Hare expansion, the Riverwalk in Chicago, universal pre-K, free community college, minimum wage increase, and the creation of a tech hub. It's kind of what you listed in the book as being on that list. So I'm curious about what's on your big goals list now.
Well, I kind of just gave you one, which is just to figure out this time and to understand where we are as a country, what is facing us, what are some of the opportunities. I mean, look, in the end of the day, I would always bet long on America. I would. And I'm trying to understand, I think, this particular time. Now, the interest, so two things I would say, let me back up actually before I run into this. So, President Obama every year would write our to-do list for 2010, 2009. And I have as my going away gift framed by him that sheet. And then it's with a little card with his horrible left-handed writing. Not bad for a year. And we would go through it. We met every day, multiple times, not every day, but in the morning we met, and then at the end of the day. And then once a week we would go over the list on every item. I have a card every day. I start Sunday, I go through and I write my week goal. And then I had a card during the day in case something came up, just to make sure I didn't forget it, what I wanted to get done. And then for each term, I wrote my big ideas for the term, or goals for the term. And each year, I updated to make sure. Late Senator Paul Simon gave me advice when I was running for Congress, which I've used, which is every year update your five-year plan. And right now I'm in the middle of trying to figure out what that five-year plan is the honest truth. If I said in the immediate goal, my number one goal is to make sure we get rid of Donald Trump. That's my number one goal. I think that is for a, you know, what's in the way I look at this is our political system and our economic system, when you look at the principles, are basically in conflict. And inside the economic system and inside the political system are contradictions. And every time that those contradictions have collided, you know, slavery, the Depression, we've been fortunate, or luck, or whatever, to have either a president that spoke to the malice towards none and charity towards all, or a president who talked to us about nothing to fear but fear itself. That moment of conflict, where both the inherent contradictions, the internally and externally, in this moment, we are unfortunate to have a president who's trying to exacerbate those conflicts and pit one American against another. And I'm trying to also understand how we fell for it. Not him, but what is it that, you know, what is it about this particular moment? And, well, he's bad, et cetera, but he did get elected. So what is it that we allowed, that it would allow us to have a president this time, that would take all these, this conflict? And remember, I mean, slavery was not easy. I mean, this is not the worst of times we've ever faced. Why is it at this particular moment, though, this particular rupture, that this is what's come about? And I think that, to me, is I want to get rid of them, but I also want to understand what we have to do to heal ourselves as a country.
Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back soon with another episode.